In the matter of State versus Arthur Wildgoose, can we please have appearances of counsel?
Maynard representing Arthur Wildgoose, Your Honor. I'm joined by my associate, Caitlin Kent.
Welcome, counsel. Before we begin, two matters. Number one, Justice Pierre-Louis will be participating in this case and will be watching remotely. And second, I'd ask all parties to rest on the papers with respect to the conflict, the argument about the conflict between NERA and the Jessica Lunford Act, and instead focus on the graduated plea provisions within the GLA. Mr. Maynard, please.
Quick question, Your Honor, before I begin. By graduated plea provisions within the...
Within the JLA.
Right. The graduated plea provisions, as I understand, would be in the guidelines. The JLA provides for reduction.
Yes. I want you to stay away from the NERA argument. Rest on your papers for that.
I'll try to do that. Thank you. Yes. I'd like to ask, make an opening statement and reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I might. May it please the court. This case arises from conflicting provisions within three bodies of law: the Jessica Lunsford Act, or JLA, the Attorney General Guidelines, or Guidelines, and the No Early Release Act. The disharmony that prevents these three bodies of law from functioning together is caused by the widespread misunderstanding and misuse of four critical terms, which are at the heart of this case. The state's briefing demonstrates the problem by using some of these terms interchangeably, but these terms are not interchangeable, and their distinct legal meaning makes all the difference, in how the JLA, NERA, and the guidelines function together. I have NERA woven in, but I'll try to skip.
Understood.
Thank you. Function together or fail to do so. The first phrase is term of incarceration, which means the total custodial sentence imposed by the court. It is important to note that the term of incarceration is reduced by various prison credits, such as commutation and work credits. The second phrase is maximum date, or max date. The max date is calculated by subtracting prison credits from the term of incarceration. The max date is when the prisoner must be released. The third phrase is term of parole ineligibility. This is the period during which the prisoner is ineligible to be considered for parole release. However, a term of parole ineligibility has no effect on the defendant's max date. The final phrase is mandatory minimum term of incarceration, or mandatory minimum. This refers to the imposition at sentencing of a minimum period of incarceration, such as NERA. A mandatory minimum cannot be reduced by any type of prison credits. Therefore, mandatory minimum terms of incarceration are served in their entirety, day for day, irrespective of parole eligibility or max dates. The misunderstanding of these four definitions leads to the three main issues exemplified by this case. First, the Attorney General guidelines directly conflict with the legislative intent and statutory language of the JLA. Second, there is widespread confusion about the term of parole ineligibility of the JLA. It is often mistaken for the mandatory minimum of NERA. Third, the guidelines, as written, make it impossible for defendants to enter a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary plea to a Lunsford Act offense. I want to conclude by taking a minute to discuss the remedy required in this case and others like it. Basically, the remedy to the situation presented in this case requires two things: fix the law and be fair to defendants. Regarding fixing the law, there are two primary problems with the current legal architecture involving the JLA. The first primary problem is the conflict between the guidelines and the language and intent of the JLA. There are three primary conflicts between the provisions of the guidelines and the JLA that this court should harmonize. First, The JLA requires equal terms of incarceration and parole ineligibility. The guidelines allow unequal terms, which are also illegal sentences. Second, the JLA permits plea offers as low as 15 over 15 at any point in the proceedings. The guidelines limit plea offers to no less than 25 over 15 pre-indictment and 25 over 18 post-indictment. Additionally, no reduction of the term of incarceration is permitted under the guidelines, which eliminates the JLA's primary motivational tool to spare the victim from trial. Third, the JLA requires all motivational plea offers to be based solely on the interest of the victim. The guidelines escalate the plea offer automatically based on indictment without consideration of the victim, the interests of the victim. The second primary problem that must be fixed, must be addressed to fix the law is the relationship between the JLA and NERA. Now, Your Honor, here's where I have some specific things about the conflict there, but
why don't we pass
it only a paragraph, but I'll pass it at your request. Hard for me to do, but I'll do it. Regarding fairness to defendants, ones for defendants who go to trial based on the state's misrepresentation of the law regarding sentencing consideration or consequences are just as aggrieved as defendants who take a plea based on such misrepresentations, neither has made a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary decision in the critical plea or trial assessment. Whether to take a plea or go to trial are two sides of the same decision. Intellectual honesty and fundamental fairness demand that we acknowledge this modern fact of life that has become central to our criminal justice system. And if the standard for taking a plea is that it be knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, then the standard for the corollary decision to go to trial or not to take the plea must be the same. It is clear for guidance, it is time for clear guidance from this court that establishes proper standards and safeguards for those whose decision to go to trial was based on misinformation or other material due process defect. It is well settled law that the remedy for a defendant who has taken a plea that is not knowing, intelligent, and voluntary is to vacate that plea. The remedy for the defendant who went to trial and was convicted due to misrepresentation of the law should be no different. In both instances, the defendant must be returned to the status quo ante or the plea of the plea or trial decision. This case presents a broad palette of issues: conflict of law, administration of justice, fundamental fairness, even separation of powers. All of the issues presented here require the attention of this court. All Lunsford defendants need the fairness that only this court can provide. And harmonizing the JLA, the guidelines, and NERA will benefit youthful victims of sexual offense. Thank you. I'll have to answer any questions.
Can you address a procedural matter? This matter on remand from the appellate division in the PCR proceeding goes back to the trial court for a hearing. After the trial court rules, was there an application by defendant to the appellate division?
Yes.
What was the application?
The application that was made was to address the court's ruling in the regarding the indictment penalty. And that the prosecutor, basically what happened is the appellate division remanded with a requirement that the trial court conduct a proceeding wherein the prosecutor would provide a written statement of reasons. And we even had a brief evidentiary hearing where we took testimony regarding the prosecutor's reasoning for not offering a pre-indictment offer. So it was all about why the prosecutor didn't offer a pre-indictment offer, which we viewed as an extension of ATC, the requirement that ATC has that offers that are made to Lunsford defendants for reduced sentences be explained in writing. So that's what ATC held. And we viewed what the appellate division did as an extension of that by requiring the prosecutor to explain why they didn't extend a pre-indictment offer to that particular defendant. Now, we had that hearing. The prosecutor produced a document that made their explanation. At the end of that proceeding, the court ruled that the explanation of the prosecutor was adequate and that there was no abuse of discretion. It was basically an inquiry of whether or not there was an abuse of discretion or arbitrariness in the fact that the prosecutor didn't make a pre-indictment offer.
And that's the trial court.
That's the trial court. Still talking about what happened in the trial court. So we disagreed that post hoc, after the fact, explanation of the prosecutor's reasoning for not making a pretrial offer was in any way curative of the issues between the guidelines and the JLA, which prevented a motivational plea offer.
Did you file an appeal after the remand hearing to the appellate division?
Yes, it was remanded. We had the hearing, the judge ruled, and we've appealed that, and it's currently stayed pending the outcome of this matter.
How did you get here? Usually, process, of course, goes appeal to the appellate division, ruling by the appellate division, cert petition to this court.
Sure. The petition for cert that we filed here encompasses other issues. We have conflicts between the JLA and guidelines in this matter.
What happened in the appellate division? Was there a motion made to the appellate division?
Okay, so let me just say this. First of all, what went to the appellate division, what we appealed to the appellate division was the ruling of the court that there was not an arbitrariness and that there was any...
Sorry, you actually filed your petition before the remand, right? That's how you got here to begin with.
No, the remand...
The appellate division decided the case and you filed a petition in the fall of 2024, right? After the appellate division's decision.
I want to say, I don't know if we filed the petition for cert before or after, but when I think it would have been after because
here
we appealed.
That you filed a petition for certification on September 9th, 2024.
For certification?
On September 9th, 2024. Is that incorrect? After the appellate division's decision.
I would need to look at, my associate says it's correct, so it must be correct.
So the appellate division issues a published opinion. You petition for cert. Then there's also a remand, correct?
There's a remand, right. The outcome of that was a remand. So it went back to the trial court. We had our hearing. The prosecutor submitted its written statement of reasons.
So again, this is a procedural question. So cert petition is granted by this court,
mm-hmm.
and the matter still proceeds at the trial court. Was there any debate as to that?
No, in fact, I think it's seen as being different aspects, different issues that arise from the matter. The matter that what was what, the remand encompassed a very narrow lane of issues.
Understood. Why don't you go ahead with your merits argument?
Yeah, and the indictment penalty, because it's an automatic escalation itself.
Before you get to that, you mentioned a stay, and I believe that's also in your papers. Who stayed any aspect of this?
The appellate division, as I understand it, has currently stayed any ruling on the appeal we filed after the trial court hearing.
Yeah, and so you filed another appeal, or did you file a motion for reconsideration?
We did file a motion for reconsideration because we felt that the appellate division remedy of remanding for a written explanation, requiring written explanations, was inadequate to address all of the issues in this matter. So we viewed it as a functional denial of our case where we raised these other issues.
What is the form of the appeal that you filed in the appellate division after the remand? That's what appears to be missing. So that's separate from your motion for reconsideration?
They denied our motion for reconsideration, and then they remanded it for the hearing. And we had
filed the motion for reconsideration before the remand.
Yes.
The appellate division issues a public decision, a published decision. Right. You petition for certification, correct? This is September of 2024. We then grant that, I believe, on May 13th, 2025. In the interim, 2 weeks before we granted, at the end of April, the PCR court holds this remand hearing and issues a decision that same day, correct?
No, I don't know if it's the same day or not.
That wasn't the question, but we were granting the initial petition that you filed in September of 2024.
Yes.
Can I ask just a even more go back question? Okay. You are complaining about a lot of things that happened in 2016, and you're complaining that the guidelines are illegal and they conflict with the statute, and they also conflict with a different statute, etc. Why didn't you raise all of this in 2016 the plea?
But there's a very simple answer. This case evolved over time. We realized things as we got drilled down deeper and deeper into the case.
But the way that the criminal process works is, even if you do realize arguments many years after the fact, you generally cannot collaterally attack a criminal conviction based on things that you could have challenged at the beginning. You agree that you could have challenged and said that the guidelines conflict with the statute all the way back in 2016 when the defendant was indicted and not offered a pre-indictment.
We did not represent him at trial.
Regardless, we
couldn't have done it when he was indicted. What I can say is...
I wasn't asking about you personally. The defendant himself...
I see, I understand.
At the time he was indicted, mm-hmm. could have said, hey, I should have been offered a pre-indictment plea, which is the exact same argument you're making now, and the guidelines conflict with the statute, could have made that argument in 2016, correct?
I think that the defendant's lawyer... certainly defendant wouldn't have had the legal knowledge or wherewithal to do any of this, but his representation might, and I wish would have, spotted all these issues and done all of that.
So why?
But are we talking about a Rule 322 here where we're saying that the issues that could have been raised at trial but weren't it can be barred, but there are exceptions in 322, and those exceptions include issues of fundamental fairness.
Fundamental fairness is the one that you
administration of justice, and several others. And so we feel that
Mr. Maynard, you're only focusing here on subsection 2 of that rule, isn't that correct?
I'm sorry.
Fundamental fairness.
No, I think this is administration. This absolutely squarely addresses our case here. It addresses administration of justice. There's conflict of laws.
Sorry, under Rule 3:22-4A, there's three exceptions, right? Mm-hmm. There's the ground for relief not previously asserted, could not reasonably have been raised in any prior proceeding. You agree that does not apply, correct?
Well, it wasn't raised, so.
It says could not reasonably have been raised.
Yeah.
It could have reasonably been raised. He could have said, actually, these guidelines that have been in existence for years conflict with the statute.
I agree with the sentiment you're saying, but, you know, lawyers are not, there's another rule that says lawyers are not held to a standard of envisioning every possible new challenge. But I go along with what you're saying.
And then number three, the denial of relief would be contrary to a new rule of constitutional law under the Constitution of the United States or the state of New Jersey.
Yeah, I don't think that applies. Right? We agree.
So the only thing we're talking about is that enforcement of the rule to preclude claims, including one for ineffective assistance of counsel, would result in a fundamental injustice, correct?
That is the primary. That is the primary thing that we are certainly relying on in overcoming a bar.
What's the fundamental injustice here? That's what I'm having trouble understanding. I see in the appellate division, they say, you know, we decide to reach this anyway. Mm-hmm. But where is the fundamental injustice where defendant chose not to plead guilty, went to trial, was convicted of many counts of things that happened a very long time ago? Where is the fundamental injustice that should now allow him to say, actually, this whole statute is unconstitutional and the guidelines conflict with the statute?
He didn't just choose to not plead guilty and go to trial. He did so based on misinformation regarding the material consequences of the plea offer, which was an illegal plea offer. directly contrary to the requirements of the Jessica Lunsford Act, which required the interests of the victim to be considered an extension of reduced motivational plea offers down to 15 over 15 pre-indictment to be extended if the interest of the victim was determined by the prosecutor to be implicated at all. And the interest of the victim in avoiding having to go to trial is certainly there and almost ever present in these matters. The fact is,
can you explain more just why was the plea offer illegal?
The plea offer is illegal because the Jessica Lunsford Act requires the term of incarceration to be equivalent to the term of parole ineligibility, and here they were not equivalent. The offer was pre-indictment, 25-year term of incarceration there was no pre-indictment offer, I'm sorry. It was a 25-year term of incarceration over an 18-year parole ineligibility. That's an illegal plea offer. Now, it was also illegal because the prosecutor was bound by the Attorney General guidelines, which forbid the prosecutor from extending any of the motivational plea offers that are provided for in the Jessica Lunsford Act. Now, that's something where the defendant had a right to the consideration and the application of the law as it existed under the Jessica Lunsford Act. That's a right. And if the prosecutor is forbidden by a rule in the Attorney General guidelines from carrying out the law, from considering those things, from extending a motivational plea offer, my client was never able to avail himself of the offers that weren't extended because the guidelines themselves forbid the prosecutor from doing that. That is in direct conflict with the Jessica Lunsford Act. And that also makes it not only fundamentally unfair, my client was never given the consideration he should have been under the law by the Jessica Lunsford Act. He should have been able to have the prosecutor assess the case, make determinations of what was in the interest of the victim, and if any of the motivational plea offers down to a 15 over 15 should be offered to my client. That was completely short-circuited.
Does Guideline 3 expressly bar the prosecutor from doing so?
Yes, they do. In the opening of the guidelines, they mention what the Jessica Lunsford Act allows, but then in the rest of the guidelines that are the instructions to prosecutors. And they say, you are bound by these instructions. There is nowhere, trust me, not one place where they authorize any reduction in term of incarceration, only in parole ineligibility. So they have taken the primary tool of the Jessica Lunsford Act, the offer of a reduced term of incarceration, because as I just read those definitions to you, it is from the term of incarceration that everything else is calculated, max states, parole ineligibilities, and so on. So the key provision of the Jessica Lunsford Act to offer motivational pleas to defendants, to induce defendants to take the plea instead of going to trial and subjecting that youthful victim to the difficulty of a trial. What's the main thing is the reduced...
Counsel, I understood your argument that in this case, the prosecutor did not extend a pre-indictment plea offer.
No pre-indictment, post-indictment. 25 over 18 post-indictment.
So I want to read for you the language in the Guideline 3. I'm sure you're familiar with it. I don't see a bar here. It says, to provide the greatest possible incentive for a guilty plea, the prosecutor may offer a plea agreement providing for a 15-year term of parole ineligibility only if the defendant agrees to plead guilty before indictment.
Your Honor is demonstrating the problem.
Where's the bar?
I'm telling you right now. Your Honor just said the bar. Parole ineligibility is not a term of incarceration. This is what's constantly being mixed up. It's even the judgment of conviction of Mr. Wild Goose calls NERA a parole ineligibility. NERA is a minimum mandatory term. A term of incarceration is not a term of parole ineligibility. They are absolutely different. The term of incarceration reduces the overall sentence from which prison credits and other things are subtracted. The difference would be an over 7-year difference, Your Honor, if there was a term of incarceration versus a parole ineligibility. The parole ineligibility only says that during the term of incarceration, you can't be considered for parole up to a certain point.
But if, I'm sorry, if the statute says that the period of parole ineligibility and the total statute have to be the same.
They do.
So then here, isn't it just using a shorthand that they're offering a 15-year term of parole ineligibility, which is a 15-year term total? Because according to the statute, they have to be the same?
No, it is not. These things, none of them are, this is why I started out with definitions. None of these are interchangeable, or they're absolutely different and they have different meanings. So, and your question, Your Honor, is starting to imply another problem that is ubiquitous, is mistaking the term of parole ineligibility for a term, a minimum term of incarceration, such as NERA. It's not that either. So the term of incarceration is the overall amount of time that a person is sentenced to. The term of parole ineligibility is some other time. It can be the same amount of time, or it can be a lesser amount of time. But the term of incarceration is reduced by credits of various types. So it can be reduced, the term of incarceration can actually be reduced below the term of parole ineligibility, such that the max date arrives before the term of parole ineligibility is up, and they release the person because he's maxed out.
So what makes a 25 with 18 illegal under that paragraph?
Because the Jessica Lunsford Act, as Justice Wiener-Apter just pointed out, requires that the terms be equivalent. The Jessica Lunsford Act...
Oh, it just says not less than 15 years.
I'm sorry, which one are you referring to?
It says term of imprisonment of not less than 15 years, and during which defendant shall not be eligible for parole. So it's speaking to both elements.
That's the Jessica Lunsford Act you're reading. That's not what the Attorney General guidelines say. The Attorney General guidelines say, do not allow for a reduction of term incarceration, only for reductions of the term of parole ineligibility. The term of incarceration that is required by the Attorney General guidelines is 25 years, no reduction. The term of parole ineligibility is 15 prior to indictment, 18 after indictment, always 25-year term of incarceration.
This argument made to the PCR court?
The arguments we realized in the...
Simple question.
Okay, but I can only answer things the way I can answer them. We realized that some of these other issues occurred during our appellate briefing.
Is that no?
We put them in the reply brief. So they were raised before the appellate court.
We're talking about PCR court, sorry. PCR. The answer was PCR. No, right?
In the PCR court, in the appellate court.
Yeah, so the answer to my question, which is, was this raised before the PCR court, is no?
In the first instance, before the remand, no.
Isn't this, and it also could have been raised on direct appeal, and it could have been raised at the time that the plea wasn't offered. It just seems like it's waiver upon waiver upon waiver, where all of a sudden, 10 years after the fact, now new arguments are being discovered.
No, I don't think it's quite like that. But what it is a series, a progression of evolving understandings of these interacting bodies of law. We realized, we first saw the what we referred to as the indictment penalty. That means that without any offer or any refusal of an offer pre-indictment, the Attorney General guidelines required that if someone was indicted, that there was an escalation in the term of parole ineligibility from 15 years to 18 years. That was the genesis of all this, where we started to say there's a problem there that's not fair. It's not in the consideration of victim. It's automatic, and it conflicts with the Jessica Lunsford Act, which we realized later. Now, and we realized the several other problems that are now incorporated in this matter when we were doing our reply brief in the appeal.
You are aware, Mr. Maynard, that in all but the rarest circumstances, issues on appeal have to be raised before the trial court, or in the case of a PCR, before the PCR court.
Well, I don't know that they're the rarest of circumstances, but they have to have a certain degree of merit, which I think these abundantly do. Here we have a situation.
It's not just meritorious or non-meritorious. Generally, you raise issues for trial courts, or in the case of PCR, PCR court, in order to preserve them for appeal.
When I say merit, I mean under 322, the exceptions to bar matters being barred that weren't raised below. That's what I mean by merit. And I think this this case more than qualifies for that exception, because what we're doing is we have a situation where there are conflicts of law, so administration of justice is implicated. We have a case where there are
But aren't we really talking about two different procedural issues? Because 322 is about raising issues that were not raised at an earlier time, direct appeal, et cetera.
I thought that was what the question was.
Right. No, I'm talking about that you filed a PCR, and or defendant filed a PCR, and there are issues raised on a PCR. And my question to you is, which I think you said no, is was this argument raised as part of the defendant's PCR? And I think he answered no to that.
No to the initial PCR. Remember, there was really two versions of that. One pre the remand, and then one after the remand where we appealed.
Which then the appellate division decision that you're here appealing was the result or was an appeal from the PCR court's determination prior to the remand. The remand is later, it's narrow, it deals with a particular issue there. But was this argument that you are making raised before the PCR court so that the PCR court would have an opportunity to address it?
I think it was after, in the hearing after the remand, where we had the testimony of the prosecutor and their statement of reasons.
That's after your appeal, and that's after your petition for certification. So what I'm asking is, I understand there was a remand.
The second appeal.
Which is now stayed, you said, correct?
I'm sorry? Yeah, it's now stayed.
So we're still talking about the first appeal. Because you filed a petition for certification after the first appellate division decision, and we granted it immediately after the remand when nothing had been filed about the remand.
My recollection of it is that we raised these subsequent issues in our reply brief of our initial appeal. That's when we started to.
That's for the first time.
Yeah. So procedurally, it is what it is. And I'm sure your honors will, if this is an issue that that the court believes is in some way either dispositive or controlling, I'm sure you'll figure out what that record is. I can't change it no matter what I say here, other than to say that I believe there is an abundant merit to continuing to justify this court hear and resolve these matters that have been raised because of their public importance, because they involve fundamental fairness. To have a defendant just
one more thing. I'd like you to confirm, and it could be after the lunch break, exactly what is pending during the appeal from the PCR proceeding at the trial court level. What are the issues in front of the appellate division that are stayed? And I'm not trying to hide the eight ball here. I want to compare that to the issues that you've raised with us now.
Right. I'll get that for you after lunch break. I know I have it I have a voluminous documents for preparation of all this. I have it.
Let's do a few more minutes now.
I have a whole timeline. I could actually give it to you if you want to look at it during lunch. So here we have a situation where defendants are not being offered this primary tool that the legislature has crafted to avoid youthful victims of sexual offending having to go to trial.
But and here the prosecutor actually testified. Whether we agree that there should have been a remand or there shouldn't have been a remand, there was a remand. The prosecutor testified that here the victim was not opposed to testifying at trial. So if the whole case is only about, you say there's a conflict with the statute because the statute is all about the desire of the victim, and here the trial court found as a matter of fact that the victim was not opposed to testifying at trial, then what are we talking about?
All right. First of all, the prosecutor's after the fact explanation of what happened is a post hoc version of, and I'm not saying it's untrue, but
PCR court found it, quote, 100% credible. Right?
I know what the PCR court found.
And we are required to agree to that unless there's not substantial evidence in the record, right? We have to defer to the PCR court's credibility findings, correct?
I understand that. Okay. But here's the other thing.
And sorry, the specific testimony was, quote, the victim and mother were not seeking to avoid a trial, quote. And that's what the trial court found was 100% credible.
The fact of the matter is the prosecutor also testified quite clearly that her motivation in not making a pre-indictment offer was to keep the defendant in jail for 30 something years so that the victim could get to be 30 years old before he was ever released. That is, but this is what's on appeal, Your Honor. This is the issue. And that's why it's different from this.
I'm sorry to come back to this, but now I think we're mixing apples and oranges. Whatever the issues that may be in front of this court as a result of the grant of certification, they do not include what happened at the PCR court's remand hearing. I thought you were going to be presenting arguments that were raised in your cert petition.
These are the articles I am presenting. What I've gone through today, Your Honor, is...
You're relying on testimony from the PCR proceeding, which is separate from the legal issues that pivot off of the appellate division's determination in this case and the published opinion that Judge Susswine issued.
I'm only answering the question. I don't think we should be talking about any of this. I think that the fact is we have on appeal the matter that's on appeal is on appeal because of the way in which the prosecutor explained what their decision was, which we think is arbitrary. And
what should we not be talking about?
I'm sorry?
What should we not be talking about?
Well, we should be talking about what was in our petition for certification, which is identifying these conflicts of law and the way in which they work injustice in the proceeding that affected my client, which is the conflict between the JLA and the Attorney General guidelines, what effect it has on the process and that there is that conflict produces.
And the appellate division's decision didn't actually deal with any of this. It only dealt with the constitutional issues, right? And so these are new. You say you raised them in your reply to the appellate division, but they didn't even consider them. You agree you never raised them to the PCR court, but now you say that's what this case should be about.
The appellate division ignored, but we raised a number of issues.
It's the same as did not reach, correct?
We did include these issues in our reply brief. The state never objected to it. I argued them before the appellate court. I argued these issues.
They did not reach them, correct?
They did not reach them. They only decided that one thing, the state had an obligation, if they were not going to make a pre-indictment offer, to explain why, as an extension of the ATC case and the separation of powers issue that the ATC case identified.
There was no ruling, for example, with respect to your argument about NERA.
No ruling whatsoever.
Was that argument actually before the appellate division?
Yes. We put it in our reply brief and I argued the NERA. I argued the conflict between the JLA and guidelines. So it was in our reply brief.
But presumably they could have decided that it was waived because it was never raised before the PCR court, correct?
I don't think they could have decided that because they accepted. They didn't decide that.
I understand you're saying they didn't refer to it at all, but you agree it was never raised before the PCR court, correct? Before the PCR court, there were a bunch of constitutional challenges.
The issues beyond what we referred to as the indictment penalty were raised for the first time in our reply brief in the appeal from that denial.
They were not raised in the PCR court.
They were not raised in the PCR court. They were raised in the reply brief of our appeal of that matter, but...
Are you still pressing all of the constitutional arguments that were before the PCR court and that the appellate division decided?
Sure. I'm pressing... The appellate division decision, while I appreciated, all the thought that they put into it, It responded to one narrow piece of this, which was the separation of powers issue that arises from why the court, the judiciary, being able to assure that the executive branch was not acting arbitrarily. That's the judicial review. So they
denied your due process arguments multiple. They denied.
When you say they, the trial court or the
appellate division?
The appellate division never commented, never denied, never reached. They simply ignored.
The appellate division didn't deal with your due process arguments?
No.
Are you in the published opinion by Judge Susswine, there's no mention of that? Of
check
the due process and the right to counsel arguments? That's
it
not
says
in the
we need
division?
Only briefly address defendant's argument the guidelines graduated plea provision violates due process. That argument presupposes there's a constitutional right to a plea offer. It fails because there is no such right. And then it goes on to explain why your due process argument fails. So they might not have agreed with you, but they didn't ignore your due process argument. They specifically say it fails.
I don't view that as an opinion. I view that as a conclusory statement. Is that a denial? Does that explain?
I think saying it fails means that they think it fails.
Okay. If that's my interpretation.
And then there's the same thing on the constructive denial of counsel theory, where they again say they suffers from the same basic problem. There's no constitutional right. And so that argument fails. So they address each of your constitutional arguments, perhaps not in the way you wanted them to, and say each one fails.
Okay. If that's, I understand that it fails is a statement that conveys a conclusion. I accept it as a denial, if that's the interpretation. My recollection, standing here, of what the appellate division did was they did not substantively respond, and maybe that's what I was thinking of, and they made only a ruling of any substance regarding the indictment penalty
what
and the procedure
it,
that
was
they...
What was the argument on your motion for reconsideration? There's a denial of it in the record without mm-hmm. just a... an appellate division order denying.
Would it be helpful for you to check your notes? We break
sure.
for lunch, and then you can fill in the two gaps we've asked about. And after that, I'd like us to move to what's wrong with the appellate division decision, to use common parlance, and focus on the issue of the court granted cert. Let's take a break.
Can you just say what issue that is that you're referring to, Your Honor?
This is not a place to raise new arguments. It's not a place to raise arguments that haven't been presented and ruled on by others. We have a cert petition and a grant that should guide where we head this afternoon.
So the question raised in our petition of cert, that would be it, right?
Let's take a 30-minute break.
Thank you, Your Honor.